It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jov Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. How was the trip?
The trip was fine. We drove 8,000 miles, and contributed to the record oil company profits. And to mentioned a couple weeks ago, we saw a lot of evidence of global warming, and of course, I helped contribute to that. That was a good thing.
And good for you.
Yeah, and I'm really glad we didn't fly, as it turned out. And I suppose we'll be talking about that and about the oil companies also later on in the show. So, got a lot to cover today.
All right, so were you close by when Joe Lieberman had to throw in the towel?
No, we'd actually fled New England by that point, but it was still great news, even though Counterspin mentioned in the last half hour, the Beltway Pendotocracy seemed pretty appalled, as they had all through the Ned Lamont candidacy. It really was a triumph for democracy in that an incumbent who was seriously out of step with his own constituents. I mean, poll after poll has shown not just the Democrats. I mean, you had all of these Beltway pundits saying that it was, radical anti-war extremists were fueling the Ned Lamont campaign. Well, every poll that's out there now is showing that 60% of the American public opposes this war. That's the mainstream. And Lieberman is out of touch with the mainstream. He was not a centrist. He was an extremist. He was in lockstep with the Bush administration, and we saw that after the election, where he's basically going out as an independent candidate, repeating the Republican National Committee and Bush administration talking points, both on Iraq and on Ned Lamont and on the Democratic Party, trashing the Democratic Party, and yet you're still seeing, to their credit, the Democrats on Capitol Hill have by and large endorsed Lamont in the election and said they'll stand by him. But and Maria Cantwell included, which was certainly a concern since Cantwell is very much a quote-unquote moderate like Lieberman. But at the same time, they're all saying nice things about Joe, which Joe can use in his campaign ads, of course. And they're keeping Joe in the Democratic caucus, even though he has officially left the Democratic Party and is going on national TV and trashing the Democratic Party. He's still got all his committee assignments. He's still got all the perks that come with being a Democrat, even though he is opposing the candidate that was supported by the Connecticut State Democratic electorate. All that being said, I think it's a tremendous shot in the arm for grassroots Democratic Party activists all over the country. And the Connecticut election obscured the fact that congressional members in Michigan and Georgia also lost in their primaries on Tuesday. And that combined with the Lamont candidacy, and remember that he was below 20% in the polls like 3 months ago. I mean, he really came on very, very strong. It shows that there is not just tremendous anger at the Bush administration and people like Lieberman who have associated themselves with the Bush administration, but with Congress and with incumbents in general. And if that momentum can be kept up between now and November, you could see a real sea change in what Congress and Capitol Hill looks like come next January.
All right. Moving along, the federal court ruling this week that will affect all of us.
Yeah, this didn't get a whole lot of attention. Of course, it was a busy news week, but the U.S. District Court in Eastern Virginia ruled on a kind of obscure case involving a couple of AIPAC members who have been charged in connection with an Israeli espionage case. But the ruling in this case is pretty disturbing. It is that the Espionage Act covers anyone who knowingly receives and transmits classified information. And now you think about this. This could also include any reporter, for example, who knowingly receives and transmits classified information, such as the Secret Army investigational report of Abu Ghraib or the Washington Post report on the CIA gulag of prisons in Eastern Europe or the New York Times report on the NSA spying scandal. All of those reporters now could, under this ruling, conceivably be charged with espionage, with treason, as a result of this ruling, if it holds up under appeal, which, it very well may. Interestingly enough, the judge in this case, a guy named T.S. Ellis III, is a Reagan appointee. It really underscores how a full generation of conservative court appointees, and that includes under Clinton, because Clinton vetted most of his federal court appointees with conservative Republicans, has really has the potential to damage things long term, and it underscores why people in Connecticut were upset with Lieberman. It wasn't just the war. It was a host of different ways in which he and other establishment Democrats have sided with the Republican agenda. Lieberman opposed filibuster efforts for both Roberts and Samuel Alito when their nomination to the Supreme Court, and he's voted for virtually every federal judge appointee and of the Bush administration. And, you know, those kind of votes can come back to haunt us for decades, and we see that with rulings like this.
All right. And the Bush administration is working on Medicare, but the timing seems a little odd.
Yeah, a couple interesting reports on Bush administration plans for upcoming congressional sessions, since Congress only has something like 15 working days left in the calendar year. Must be nice to have a job like that. But a report out this week that the Bush administration is drafting plans for severe cuts in Congress for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. That's going to be their big push after the November election with the new budget in January of 2007, after Bush has become a lame duck and, you know, doesn't have to worry about answering to voters. Of course, after the presidential election in 2004, trying to privatize Social Security was Bush's big push, and he failed. They're coming back after that again, and also going after Medicare and Medicaid. The new Treasury Secretary announced this talk this week about how that was the biggest threat to the economy, and they're clearly prioritizing that. So keep an eye on that. Also, a Washington Post report went on Wednesday that the Bush administration has drafted amendments to the War Crimes Act that would retroactively prohibit policymakers from possible criminal charges for authorizing any humiliating and degrading treatment of prisoners, torture, for example, et cetera, according to lawyers who have seen the proposal. The draft legislation, according to these lawyers, policymakers who would be retroactively covered to ignore the Geneva Conventions, even though the U.S. Supreme Court just ruled a couple of months ago that that was the law of the land. So once again, the Bush administration trying to not only subvert the will of Congress, which passed the bill, you know, last December outlawing torture, but also the U.S. Supreme Court. It really is once again, you know, the imperial presidency come to fruition. And it's one reason that people are so upset with Congress, is because it has rolled over and played dead for the Bush administration for the last 6 years.
All right. Well, from the Timing is Everything department, we heard this week that BP Oil is saying that their pipeline is kind of wearing out.
Yeah, and there are some very good reports out there. Greg Palast and Jason Leopold, both of whom have experience reporting on energy issues in Alaska, have both had very, very good material out on this. And also there's a whistleblower. There have been whistleblowers coming out for BP for the last 15 years, basically saying that the pipeline is corroded, that BP isn't putting money into maintenance of the system, that there's a real severe possibility of a major environmental disaster along the lines of Exxon Valdez. This has been brought to the attention of federal regulators, particularly under the Bush administration, who have chosen to ignore it. It really is a tale of horrible mismanagement of an environmentally sensitive area for a number of years, and it's been very, very well documented. BP did choose at the beginning of the week to announce that it would shut down its Prudhoe Bay oil operations. Of course, they then announced on Friday, after oil had gone up a couple of dollars a barrel, that they could in fact redo it on the western half of their Prudhoe Bay operation. They would only shut down the eastern half. Now, it's the western half, mind you, the half that they're going to restart again with a wink and a nod from federal regulators, that was the site of a massive oil leak in March, 250,000 100,000 gallons that went on, you know, went on to the Alaskan tundra. But that supposedly is okay now. And they've had the technology to check all of this, the so-called smart pig, for a number of years, but they haven't bothered to invest in it. So why now, you have to ask? Well, there's a couple of interesting reasons. Number one, it's summertime. There's already crises in the Middle East, which we'll obviously get to. And oil is much more expensive now than it was even you know, 3 years ago. And because it's summertime and therefore a time of peak demand, you have the opportunity, and Ron Stahl, to manipulate the market. Now, a lot of Alaskan oil happens to go here to the West Coast, which I can attest from my recent drive and from being in, you know, Memphis, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia a couple of months ago, that we have some of the most expensive gas in the country here on the West Coast. That's becoming even more expensive now because much of our gas comes from Prudhoe Bay, and they're you know, going to raise the prices as a result. Now, as it happens in California, which is by far the largest market on the West Coast, by far the largest distributor is ARCO, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of BP. So guess who wins at both ends? They both drive up the price at the wholesale end of how much oil costs a gallon because they're withholding oil from the market, and then at the retail end they make money from that as well. Now the other part of that, and then they're going to turn around and restart operations, so they still get to sell some of the oil after all. Now in terms of the rest of the shutdown, which they say is going to last until early next year, that happens to last until just after the Bush administration is freed up to do things and at the end of the midterm elections, such as, for example, invading Iran, you know, other things that could raise the price of oil right after they have more of it to sell. So there's a number of ways in which the timing of this is very, very suspicious, and it underscores once again how dangerous drilling in Anwar would be, because it's the exact same consortium of operators, BP in the lead. It's the exact same technology, and it's just as or even more environmentally sensitive than Prudhoe Bay is.
All right. Well, moving along, the other big item of the week was the terror plot that was supposedly foiled from planes coming over from the UK.
Yeah, and
no more liquids.
Yeah, and it does look like a serious plot. Now, I have to say at this point that I couldn't have flown home if I'd needed to, because I have a immunosuppressant medication that I have to take twice a day in order to survive, and it is a liquid, and I'm not about to check it on the airlines and have them lose it because it costs something like $1,300, you know, per prescription, and I can't just walk into a pharmacy somewhere on the other side of the country and reorder it. There are a lot of people who are being massively inconvenienced by the knee-jerk reaction in terms of the security at the airports as a result of this plot. And it is a serious plot. At the same time, let's remember a couple of things. Number one, British authorities stopped this plot using investigative police powers. And not only that, but police powers that they had prior to 9/11. Nothing that has happened in the last 5 years did anything to enhance the British police authority to stop this plot. They did it as a result of basic investigative work. Not without additional curtailments of civil liberties, without military action, etc. In fact, you could almost certainly make the argument that as these were apparently British citizens who launched this plot, it was made much more possible by actions that have been taken in the past 5 years, namely all the things that the U.S. in particular has done to incite more people to want to wage jihad against the West and against the United States. In terms of the security precautions that are now being taken in U.S. airports, it's kind of preposterous. I mean, what is the benefit versus what is the risk? You're never going to be able to entirely prevent terrorist attacks. You try and minimize it, and the best way to minimize it is by a couple things, by intelligence and police work, number one, and by winning the hearts and minds so that you have fewer of these people trying to wage jihad and less of a population that broadly supports them in the Muslim world. In terms of the security precautions, Well, I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to drain people's bodies of blood because it's a liquid? I mean, it becomes preposterous at a point. All Al-Qaeda would need is a surgeon and an anesthesiologist who'd be willing to do it, and you could put a container with some sort of explosive and a computer chip with a timer on it in somebody's abdominal cavity, or do it to about 15 or 20 willing martyrs, and they can go walking right through an airport screener. They can just say they've got some shrapnel in their spine or a pacemaker or whatever if the metal detector goes off. And there's absolutely nothing you can do to prevent it. There are ways, if a group like Al-Qaeda wants to bring down an airliner, that it always will be done. The threat of liquid explosives was used in a plot that was uncovered more than a decade ago out of the Philippines. I mean, it's been a known tactic. It was just as much of a danger a week ago as it is now. So a lot of this is being done for show, just as the terror alerts are being done for show, just as the Bush administration used the advanced knowledge of the news to launch partisan attacks on Democrats for being weak on terror midweek this week. Dick Cheney in particular, not surprisingly, leading that, but also Ron Mailman at the Republican National Committee and several other people. It really is a case where this is being overblown for political purposes, number one, where the very real threat that exists has been part of a need to prevent terror that has really been subverted by the Bush administration, by the war in Iraq, rather than trying to go directly after Osama bin Laden and after Al-Qaeda, by all of the things that have been done in the Middle East, including Iraq, including our mindless support of Israel. Those are the two biggest that have continued to incite a new generation of Muslims to want to try and come after us. This administration has been a disaster for foreign policy, and this plot shows it. It's very sad.
All right. Well, that leads us over to international and the continuing situation in Lebanon.
Yeah. Good news this morning, apparently, that UN Security Council last night unanimously passed a resolution crafted by the U.S. and France that would send 15,000 more better funded, better trained UN peacekeeper force to southern Lebanon, to a 15-mile buffer zone between the border and the river that Israel had threatened earlier this week to invade up until. At the same time, the Lebanese government has pledged to match that with an additional 15,000 of its own security forces to help patrol that buffer region to keep out anybody who could attack Israel, basically. But you have to ask several questions. The most prominent of them is why this couldn't have happened a month ago. And the biggest reason it couldn't have happened a month ago is that the United States was giving diplomatic cover to Israel and was threatening to veto in the Security Council any resolution that was not to Israel's liking. And Israel wanted to be able to wage this war for a certain period of time and attack Lebanon for a certain period of time before it agreed to any ceasefire, which apparently this will represent. Israel has said it's acceptable to them. Hezbollah has been saying since the inception that they would be amenable to a ceasefire if it were guaranteed, if Israel abided by it. There was a report in the San Francisco Chronicle this week, for example, that the bombing and invasion of Lebanon had been planned for 2 years, that this was a plan that was sitting on the shelf waiting to be implemented when the Israeli leadership felt that there was an opportune moment, and that opportune moment came with the killing of 8 soldiers and kidnapping of 2 others on the border about a month ago. As we've said all along, the media coverage of this has been horrible because there have been border incursions on both sides pretty regularly, particularly both the Israelis into Lebanon over the last 6 years or so. Now we have evidence that this is a pre-existing plan by Israel to do this, and the Hezbollah attack was a pretext for it. That has not gotten widespread media coverage at all. We've seen Condi Rice, who had to cancel her trip to Beirut after the Qana bombing a couple of weeks ago because even the Lebanese prime minister said basically that Condoleezza Rice was not welcome in his country, which is a remarkable statement to say. Rice is talking about the birth of a new Middle East, looking, something like the Birth of a Nation video, movie by D.W. Griffith. the United States has really badly forfeited any credibility it might have once had in the Middle East, and it has become that much more of a target for jihadists as a result of its support of Israel and Israel's destruction of Lebanese infrastructure, Lebanese civilian infrastructure, Lebanese civilian lives. We have word now from the UN this week that an oil spill that was caused by the bombing of a power plant, which, by the way, is a war crime, it's the bombing of civilian infrastructure, could have resulted in an oil spill on the Lebanese beaches, which has been unfolding for a couple of weeks now, that's on the scale of Exxon Valdez in terms of the impact on the environment and on marine life and so forth in the Mediterranean. This has just been a disaster all the way around. It's profoundly changed the balance of power within Lebanon. Syria still is at risk of getting involved. And we also have not heard very much in this country, but the largest anti-Israeli demonstrations in the world for the past couple of weeks have been in Baghdad. This has been a profound turning point also in terms of the relationship of the U.S. to both the Iraqi government and the already unpopular American presence among Iraqi civilians. So it's been a very bad situation all the way around, and you have to ask why the ceasefire couldn't have happened much earlier.
All right, moving along, while you were gone, I'm sure you were surprised to see that apparently the Joint Chiefs of Staff have discovered that there might be a civil war happening in Iraq.
Yeah, it's kind of a shock. The Baghdad morgue, for example, reported this week that there were 1,815 deaths in the Baghdad area in the month of July. That's a new record, eclipsing by 250 the previous record, which was in June. Most of those are violent deaths. Most of those are executions by death squads. The situation has continued to spiral out of control. As I talked about a couple of weeks ago, the whole plan by the Bush administration to put an extra whopping 4,000 American troops in Baghdad is really pretty much a publicity gimmick. It's a drop in the bucket compared to what would actually be needed to bring any kind of security to a city of 5 million people that's disintegrating before our eyes, and people are trying to flee the country pretty much any way they can at this point. It's a very, very dangerous situation within Iraq right now. And as we mentioned, that also has been exacerbated by the situation with Israel and Lebanon. There have been several other sort of crises developing in the Muslim world and with the Muslim relationship with the West that have not gotten much attention either because of the Lebanon crisis. Turkey has been threatening to invade northern Iraq where the Kurds are because the Kurds have been giving shelter to separatist Kurds in southeast Turkey who have been waging a guerrilla war for a long time against the Turkish military and the Turkish government. At the same time, we also have India threatening reprisals against Pakistan for Pakistan's alleged role in helping to bankroll and train the people behind the Mumbai bombings last month. Now, this is the same Pakistan, of course, where there was an alleged connection to the British plot that was uncovered this week. Yet these guys are our close friends. So you have right now the U.S. throwing a match onto a pile of gasoline called Israel, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. Of those, Israel, Pakistan and India are all nuclear powers. Iran would like to be, and we of course have threatened to use nuclear weaponry against Iran, and it's been seriously discussed at high levels of the Pentagon and the administration. That incidentally is certainly still on the table. The U.S. talking about, or the Bush administration talking about, the possibility of a military strike against Iran, and in fact, very interesting statement this week by Colonel Wilkerson, the former chief of staff to Colin Powell during the first Bush term, and this is a direct quote. He's questioning whether, quote, let's see where did I put it here. Oh, I had it in front of me a second ago. Here we go. Questions whether this entire affair, talking about the Israeli bombing and potential invasion of Lebanon, this entire affair was ginned up by Bush Cheney and certain political leaders in Tel Aviv to give cover for the eventual attack by the U.S. on Iran. Now, isn't that an interesting scenario? We got a real mess right now in the Middle East. And, again, it's very much connected also to the terror plot that was uncovered this week in Britain. So, chickens coming home to roost and all that kind of thing.
Okay, very briefly, Mexico and the recount.
Yeah, we heard a little bit of that on Counterspin, so I won't spend too much time on it. The Election Tribunal ordering a recount of 9% of the ballots rather than all of them. Really only the ones where the numbers didn't add up. They didn't go for any of the precincts where extensive reports of fraud were taking place. And this is not likely to mollify López Obrador's supporters, 2 million of whom rallied in Mexico City a couple of weeks ago to a call for civil disobedience and sit-ins if every vote were not recounted. So this story is not going to go away anytime soon.
All right. And several events this weekend?
Yeah, we didn't get a chance to mention that Sergeant Ricky Clausing, a person who left the Army, an infantry interrogator in Iraq, left Fort Bragg a year ago. He turned himself in this week as a resistor to the war at the Veterans for Peace National Convention being held over at UW here in Seattle. That started on Thursday. He made his announcement, and that event continues through today. There's a closing event tonight at the Hub Ballroom, which looks like it'll be pretty good, so people should go and check that out. Also today, there are a couple of demonstrations against the Israeli attacks in Lebanon and U.S. support for that. Unfortunately, they happen at virtually the same time. One of them is over in Kirkland. It is the event that was postponed from last weekend, sponsored by the Arab American Community Coalition, that was postponed after the shooting of the Jewish Federation. That's going to be speakers at 11 o'clock and 11:30 at a march from Kirkland Marina Park. And then also at noon downtown at the Federal Building, there's a rally that's being sponsored by ANSWER, the Palestine Solidarity Committee, various socialist groups, and so forth. So people hopefully can get to one or the other of those.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State, and where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a local publication that a bunch of volunteers put out. We publish every couple of weeks, occasionally take an extra week in the summer. But you can find it at bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, places where you find free publications. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. It would be a lot easier at the moment to find you in those bookstores and cafes if we had more distributors. We've had some that they inevitably turn over because we're all volunteer, especially during the summer. So right now, routes downtown on Capitol Hill and Ballard and Fremont and Queen Anne and a couple other places, we need people to fill all of those. So if you're interested in helping out with that, and as I mentioned, also Tara Kent has left as co-editor because of a new actual paying job that she got that precludes her editing on weekends, which is when we do it. So we're also looking for a co-editor. So if you're interested in helping out with any of that, or if you have feedback on stories or tips, any of that kind of stuff, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947, or you can email us at info@eatthestate.org.